From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Some people are already asking the question, who lost Russia? Is Russia abandoning the dream of democracy and a market economy? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with William Taubman, a political science professor at Amherst College and the author of several books on the Soviet Union. He just returned from his latest trip to Russia. Also, we meet drummer Max Weinberg, formerly with Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, and now the leader of the band on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Weinberg's compiled a new CD series featuring his favorite rock and roll drummers from the 50s through the 70s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has nominated Boston lawyer Deval Patrick as the country's next civil rights enforcer. The president praised Patrick and said he'll make a difference. Mr. Clinton has been criticized for leaving the Justice Department position vacant for so long. His first nominee, Lonnie Guinier, was pulled last year after heavy criticism. Conservatives say that Patrick is a stealth Guinier candidate. The president is aggressively promoting his health care reform package. He spoke to the American Hospital Association and to state governors today in support of his package. The president told the governors that welfare recipients don't have incentives to leave the welfare rolls. He says passing universal health care legislation will help people return to work.
Just under 1 in 5 people who get back on welfare after they get off do so for a health-related reason. Because so many people on welfare, virtually everyone, has younger children, the loss of the health care coverage for the younger children for people who leave welfare is an enormous disincentive to get off of it.
Republican Senate Leader Bob Dole says debate over whether there's a health care crisis is just quibbling. He told the governors today he's willing to work toward a bipartisan health care plan. The ex-husband of figure skater Tanya Harding has pleaded guilty in Portland, Oregon today to one count of felony racketeering. In a plea bargain with prosecutors, Jeff Gillooly implicated Harding in the attack on fellow skater Nancy Kerrigan. Tess Vigland of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
Answering questions from Circuit Judge Donald Launder, Jeff Gillooly told the court that his ex-wife Tanya Harding was one of the people who planned the January 6th attack on Nancy Kerrigan. Gillooly implicated Harding during his discussions with the FBI last week. Prosecutors reduced the charge against him in return for his testimony. Gillooly faces a maximum sentence of 24 months in prison and a $100,000 fine. He will be back in court April 1st for formal sentencing. Attorneys for Harding issued a statement prior to the court appearance saying Gillooly's accusations were evidence of a continued practice of abusive conduct intended to destroy Harding's career. Harding continues to deny all allegations that she was involved in the assault. For National Public Radio, I'm Tess Vigland in Portland.
The government says construction spending jumped to a record high last year. The Commerce Department says construction spending rose 7.9% with a big December increase. Analysts say low mortgage rates helped boost the new construction. A private business group says American manufacturing rose in January for the fifth time in as many months. The National Purchasing Management Association says that's at its highest rate in 5.5 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 17.5 points to 3,960. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is down 4 at 795. This is NPR. American blood bank officials say they are facing a serious crisis. Officials say the nation's blood supply is dangerously low, the lowest level since World War II. Operators say if more people had been hurt in the Los Angeles earthquake, there might not have been enough blood to treat them. At least 40 American cities have faced shortages. The New York Times says the shortages are due to bad weather, a flu outbreak, and the unfounded fear of getting AIDS. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has made a call for Bosnian peace talks to continue. He says as long as the West is unwilling to intervene militarily, the only approach left is to go on negotiating. Boutros-Ghali spoke at a news conference at UN headquarters in New York. The BBC's John Line reports.
The Secretary General is at the center of a major rethink in policy towards Bosnia. On the one hand, there's little optimism about the peace negotiations. On the other hand, as he pointed out, Various member states, including Britain and France, are thinking of pulling their troops out of the peacekeeping operation. But Dr. Boutros-Ghali stressed that there was no alternative to continued talks.
For the time being, our only approach, which we have, the only approach is to continue to negotiate, in spite of the atrocity which are committed, in spite of the emotion of the international public opinion, in spite of the fact that it seemed that you are not progressing.
The Secretary General aligned himself with the Anglo-French initiative, which would involve co-opting the major international powers to pressure the warring parties into a settlement. But he also stressed his willingness to authorize the use of force. Indeed, he said the use of force would give credibility to the threat.
John Lyne reporting. Algerian reports say a French journalist was killed today and his Australian colleague was seriously wounded in a shooting attack. Security forces say it was a terrorist assault. These are the latest casualties in a series of deaths since Islamic fundamentalists began attacking foreigners. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're hearing some gloomy predictions about the future of Russia. The economic reformers resigned from Yeltsin's cabinet, and now many Americans who were looking forward to a new free market economy are worrying about economic chaos. After the December parliamentary elections, many experts warned the old guard is regaining power. Plus, extremist Vladimir Zhirinovsky's party got nearly 25% of the vote. To get a handle on the situation, we invited back William Taubman. He's the author of several books about the Soviet Union and a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's now writing a biography of Khrushchev. Taubman made his first trip to Russia about 30 years ago. His latest trip was in January. He was there during President Clinton's visit and when the economic reformers resigned.
I must say, when I got back from my recent trip to Russia and read the American press coverage of the period when I had been there, I was struck by how oversimplified it tends to be. We get the picture depicted in black and white tones. We're told there are good and bad guys. We're told there's a clash between the old and the new. We're informed that there are reformers fighting with reactionaries. But when you're over there, talking to people and living in Moscow, everything is gray. Not only the weather, but in the sense that everything is much more complex. The good guys make mistakes. The bad guys are telling at least part of the truth. The new forces are acting in old ways. The reformers have had some successes, but they've also made a mess of things. But the anti-reformers or the critics of the reformers, if they got their way, I think would make an even greater mess of things. In part because the reformers and what we call the reactionaries undermine each other, cancel each other out, prevent one or the other from acting in the kind of consistent way which might produce success.
Can you basically sum up for us what the big economic debate is between the reformers and the other people in the government?
I think so, although I'm not an economist myself, so you have to make an allowance for that. But as I understand it, what the reformers wanted to do, let's put it this way, they wanted to do four things. They wanted to stabilize the currency, they wanted to liberalize prices, they wanted to privatize firms, and they wanted to create a safety net for the people who would become unemployed in the process. And they succeeded, I think, in doing the second and third of these things. They did liberalize prices, they did privatize a great number of firms, but they failed to stabilize the currency, and they haven't created that safety net. And in the absence of that safety net, people are justifiably frightened, which raises the question of why they haven't succeeded in the things that they've failed to do. Now, they blame their critics, and they also blame the West for not coming through with big, very big bucks that they need to create this, the safety net and to stabilize the currency. But my criticism of the reformers is that they're living in an unreal world if they think that there was going to be no criticism, and if they think that the West was just going to come forward and hand them $24 billion, even though, quite true, we promised we would. In other words, they've been undermined by the realities of the world in which they live, both at home and abroad. But my feeling is that the alternative to reform, which I'll try to explain, is also has an Achilles heel. Now, what is the alternative? What the anti-reformers want to do is to keep the old, or at least the commanding heights, as the Soviets used to call them, of the old economy in action, keep the old firms going, subsidize them because they produce goods and because they produce jobs.
And these are all the old state-run industries and
right.
state-run farms.
Right. And so the question immediately arises, if you do that, then won't you have an incredible hyperinflation? And the answer of the critics, as I understand it, if they're really being honest about it, is yes, we will, but we'll stop it with wage and price controls. But the problem with this is also an aspect of Russian reality. The problem is that the government doesn't govern. And the state, although it's bloated in terms of numbers of bureaucrats, hardly exists when it comes to having authority in the minds of people. So who is going to control prices? Who's going to control wages across the length and breadth of this vast country? I don't think they could pull that off, even if they tried.
In the talk about inflation, when we look ahead and we worry about inflation in Russia, are we talking about something that's problematic or catastrophic?
Well, at the moment, inflation, it's been around 30% a month. It's gone down, I think, to about 15% a month. The technical definition of inflation is 50% a month. And what the reformers are saying now is that the subsidies to these old firms, as Chernomyrdin wants to hand them out, will produce inflation over 50% a month, which is hyperinflation. That really heads you toward Weimar Germany levels, toward Latin American levels at the worst of Latin American inflation. That is catastrophic. At the moment, it's devastating, but not yet catastrophic.
What do you make of Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the nationalist and, I guess, racist, who seems pretty scary from here, from reading the press? His party received about 24% of the party preference vote, and he's advocated restoration of the Soviet Empire, using military force to achieve national goals. How popular is he? How much power do you think he really has? Is he symptomatic of something?
I think he, well, seen from close up, as I saw him in Moscow. I didn't see him personally, but on television, and I talked to a lot of people, asked everybody about him.
Mm-hmm.
Seen from close up, he is both scarier than he is from here and more fragile, I think. When I was there, on one of the Sunday evenings when I was there, they broadcast a hour-long TV survey of the news of the week, the past week, and they devoted 5 or 10 minutes at the end to news clips of Zhirinovsky in action that week. And in one of them, he was screaming at the top of his lungs at the parliament. In another one, he was about to have a fight with a fellow deputy in a cafeteria line. In another one, he was fulminating against America as the evil empire and saying that after Russia saved the West from Napoleon and Hitler, the West should feed them for free. He appears to be at the edge of reality. But he also seems crazy like a fox. His very irrationality has the effect, I think, to some extent, of influence, of insulating him from responsibility. That is, whatever the current government does and whatever the current parliament does, people may very well say, well, Zhirinovsky is not responsible because he's not a responsible person. And this may help him preserve some, oddly enough, some credibility later on.
But you said you thought he was maybe more fragile than
well,
he appears to be.
Well, he's fragile because he seems virtually out of control.
Mm-hmm.
He looks as if any moment he will sort of sail off into space, lose control entirely. He looks as if his emotions have got the better of him. He looks as if he's psychologically capable of self-destructing before the 2 years pass, which will lead us to the next presidential election. He also looks as if he's capable of so alienating people, not only in other parties, but in his own, that he might be the victim of some kind of plot or some kind of purge.
So meanwhile, what's the military and the former secret police like now?
Well, actually, the military is holding back. It was reluctant to act in December when Yeltsin ended up ordering it to bombard the parliament. It eventually did bring itself to do so, I think with great unwillingness and distaste. It would like the politicians to do the politicking. It would like the government to govern. It would like to stay out. But as I think about the future, it seems to me the military is going to be sorely tempted to intervene far more drastically than it has so far. And my reasoning is that if I'm right, that both reform and the counter-reform program are bound to run into trouble, that means that the situation is going to get worse before it gets better. And if it gets worse and Zhirinovsky doesn't self-destruct, then he's going to be in a position to pick up the pieces. And even if he does self-destruct, it's all too likely that somebody else will appear who will then appeal to his constituency. If that is the case, then 2 years from now, they are likely to face a presidential election in which, even if Yeltsin runs, he will have been further discredited, and his health isn't that good to begin with either. Zhirinovsky will be, or somebody who replaces him, will be a very viable candidate, and the military will have to decide whether they like him enough to let him into office or whether they're frightened of him enough to take power themselves. And I think it's all too likely, if you spin this scenario out, that they will take power.
The military?
Yes.
And so in what, like a military dictatorship would be?
In some kind of a military dictatorship. I think I even see over the horizon somebody who might fill the role of dictator. There is a 44-year-old general, a kind of charismatic, very outspoken type who seems to be almost a rogue general. He is the commander of the 14th Russian Army, which is based in the Transdniester region in Moldova. And every other day he says something that really should bring him a court-martial if there were a functioning civilian control over the military. It's all too easy to imagine him or somebody like that thrusting the top defense minister Grachev and his senior colleagues out of the way and taking over. But I'll say one more thing, which probably will get me into trouble with my Russian friends and even with my own conscience. And I could see a case for the military's taking over. That is, if it gets to the point where the choice is between chaotic politics as usual and somebody like Zhirinovsky, I think the military would be the lesser evil. It might even be able to provide the stability and the consistency which would allow either the reform program or some alternative to it to go forward consistently enough to produce more success than they've had so far.
William Taubman is my guest, professor of political science at Amherst College and author of a forthcoming biography of Khrushchev. We're going to take a short break and be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with William Taubman, professor of political science at Amherst College. He traveled most recently to Russia January 8th through January 22nd. There have been rumors that Boris Yeltsin is sick and very depressed. Were you able to find out anything about that while you were in Russia?
I certainly don't have any confirmation on the basis of any personal experience. I did attend the reception for President Clinton at the American Embassy, and I'd hoped to see Yeltsin there, but he was waiting for Clinton at his dacha. But the rumors are so omnipresent as to suggest that there must be some fire where there's all this smoke. And Yeltsin has this very unnerving pattern, which could be indeed explained either by illness or by alcohol or by some other syndrome, which we don't fully understand. He has this penchant for lapsing into inactivity after a crisis, just when, by rights, he ought to move decisively to take advantage of his new strength. He's done this several times, and in some ways, he seems to be doing it again.
The Clinton administration's policy has been to tie financial aid to Russia to Russian progress toward economic reform. Now that the reformers have left the cabinet, what might change in the Clinton administration policy? What kind of decisions does our government have to make about Russia now?
Well, I must say I have my reservations about the policy.
About tying financial aid to economic reform?
Yes, it seems to me that it should not be up to us to tell them what to do and to attach conditions to our aid such that they're forced to do what we tell them. It's up to us. If we don't think they're proceeding in the right fashion, I think we're free not to to help them. But I think the worst situation is when we tell them what to do, they do it, we then don't provide the money that we've promised, things go badly, and we get blamed. I think what we need now is what might be called a little damage limitation. That is, rather than trying to make things perfect, we ought to try not to make them worse. And we ought to try to make sure that we don't become the target when things get bad.
Are we the target now?
We are increasingly the target, I'm afraid. One finds anti-Americanism growing. It's visible in all sorts of ways. I had a conversation with a kind of centrist politician while I was there, and he said that he saw his task as providing the Russians with a kind of centrist alternative to Zhirinovsky. And the whole spirit that he seems to have in mind came out in the conversation. He was full of criticism for the United States. He was full of bitterness about the advice we've given and the money that we haven't given. And if he was representative, and I think he is, the message that a lot of centrist politicians and even some liberal politicians have gotten from the Zhirinovsky phenomenon is it is politically prudent to bash the United States.
So we're perceived as having made a commitment to give money if they head toward economic reform. They tried to head toward economic reform, and we didn't follow through and give them the money.
Well, that's the least, actually, of the charge against us. On the paranoid fringe, which is where somebody like Zhirinovsky quite properly belongs, they have a kind of conspiracy theory, which is that we deliberately foisted on them a reform program, knowing that it would destroy their economy, and we're waiting to pick up the pieces. And the primary pieces that we're waiting to pick up are their very valuable raw materials, their uranium, their oil, their gas, their property, taking advantage of the fact that foreigners can now invest in Russia. In other words, this conspiracy theory turns our efforts, our constructive efforts to help them out by offering them aid and by promoting investment into a devious plot to do them in.
You were in Russia when President Clinton visited there in January. What did his trip look like from the vantage point of the Russian people and the Russian press?
Actually, having criticized just now some of the policy of the administration, I should say that Clinton himself was sensationally good.
Mm-hmm.
He came across just the way I think he wanted to, as somebody who was there to sympathize and to support, but not to dictate, and not even to give too much advice. I heard him speak at the American Embassy, and then I watched him on television during his town hall performance. And I watched this with some Russian friends who were absolutely enchanted by the natural, the easy, natural style of the president. They said to me that their politicians talk about being Democrats, but here was a man who was a Democrat in his bones, the kind of easy familiarity with the questioner combined with a kind of authority which sits gracefully on his shoulders. The moment when he called the 9-year-old Russian boy out of the audience who had recalled Clinton's handshake with Kennedy at an early stage and shook hands with this boy and said, "Now, maybe when you become Russian president, you can remember this handshake." People were really quite enchanted with him. But even there, it's interesting there the way in which the language gets in the way. I was listening on Russian television, so I could both hear him speaking in the background and I could hear the translation. Mm-hmm. And several times he said in English, talking about what the Russians have to do, he said, "Well, you'll have to do this, you'll have to do that." And the Russian translation was a phrase of "вы должны," which means "you must." And it carries with it the connotation, "I'm telling you, do this, you must do it now." So even the language or the translation problem conspires to turn his effort to offer this general sort of encouragement into what the Russians sometimes heard as as advice of the wrong sort.
You've been traveling to Russia for many years. Where do you stay now, and how does that compare to where you used to stay?
Well, if you go back far enough, I took my first trip there in the summer of 1964. All through the Soviet period, you had to stay in hotels. You weren't even allowed to stay with friends. You had to tell the Russian visa authorities before you got your visa how long you were going to spend in each place and where you were going to stay. And when you got there, you gave your passport to the hotel administrator, as it's called, the front desk, and they would register your presence with the police. Nowadays, anything goes. You still need a visa, and your visa is still for a particular period of time, but you're not asked where you're going to stay. And I and most of my American colleagues and friends now try to stay with Russian friends. We stay in apartments. And Russians are very glad to have you, both because of the friendship, but also because while you're there, you can spend some of your dollars to get food for yourself and for
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And I also try, I say to myself, if I were staying in a hotel, I'd be paying some outlandish sum. The fancy Western hotels charge New York rates now. The Metropole Hotel, when I was there a year ago, September, was already charging $250 a night for a room. They must be up toward $500 by now.
Well,
so if you contribute some small fraction of what you would pay to a hotel to your own upkeep in your friend's apartment, that is likely to amount to several months, the equivalent of several months' salary for your friends. So it's in everybody's interest. Not to mention the fact that you'll do better eating food that's prepared in somebody's kitchen than in than a hotel kitchen.
Right. Do you have a sense of popular opinion in Russia now about whether there's a lot of optimism that change for the better is possible, or a lot of cynicism that nothing good is really going to happen in the near future?
Actually, if you look at the public opinion polls that have been taken in recent weeks, they show a slight smidgen of optimism. That is, compared to polls taken several months ago or a year ago, more people say that they have hope for the future. More people think that the worst can be avoided. And until you look at the political scene and look at the parties who represent these people in parliament, you almost begin to be hopeful. But the figures are still, it is still just a smidgen. The people who are desperate or hopeless or cynical still, I think, far outnumber those who are beginning to show optimism. The change is only relative. So in that sense, this is a people who are pretty glum, who see their own situation as pretty bleak. And I think one of the most destructive aspects of the situation is that, in a sense, even though they don't say it, they blame themselves. They have a very low self-image as a country, as a people. They've lost their empire. They've lost the Soviet Union. Their economy is in a shambles. And this low self-image, I think, contributes to their willingness to support politicians who lash out at other politicians.
Bill Talman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
William Talman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's currently writing a biography of Khrushchev. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, some great rock and roll drumming from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, selected by drummer Max Weinberg, formerly of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, and now band leader on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. We'll talk with Weinberg about his new anthology, Let There Be Drums, and about his years with Springsteen. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The ex-husband of skater Tanya Harding has admitted that he helped plan the attack on skater Nancy Kerrigan. Jeff Gillooly has pleaded guilty to racketeering and agreed to a plea bargain with Oregon, Michigan, and federal authorities. He's received a 2-year sentence and a $100,000 fine. He'll agree to testify in all procedures against Harding. Gillooly alleges Harding was involved in the plot to hurt Kerrigan. Harding has maintained her innocence and is still on the Olympic team, but the U.S. Figure Skating Association has set up a panel to review the matter. The National Cable Television Association has announced its plan to curb violence on television. It would bring a rating system to television for violence, similar to the one now in place for movies. Tony Cox is chairman of the committee. He says the system will inform viewers.
Give the viewers more information, better information, about the nature of programming that is going to appear on their television sets. Essentially, we're suggesting that there should be no surprises to someone when they turn on their TV set. A well-informed viewer is a viewer who can make the right choices for themselves and their families.
The cable group has also proposed a series of standards on violence in television. The group is acting to ward off congressional legislation to limit violence. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole continued to question whether there's a health crisis today, but he's also told the nation's governors he's willing to work toward a bipartisan compromise on health care reform. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
The president told a hospital group today that anyone who thinks there isn't a crisis in health care should visit a local hospital. The Senate minority leader kept up his end of the debate by telling the nation's governors the president is resorting to theatrics when he calls the problem a crisis. Dole says he thinks there is a pretty good chance that some version of health care will pass this year, but he says the debate should not be framed as the president's plan or nothing.
It was long-term care, early retirees, prescription drugs. You add that all up, that's about $300 and some billion over the next 5 years in new spending. I don't think the votes are there. We have to decide who wins, who loses, who pays for it, and how soon.
Dole had praise for a compromise the governors have suggested, which doesn't go as far as the president's plan, but goes beyond Republican proposals and would require employers to make coverage available to their workers. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
The Federal Reserve Board's vice chairman is resigning. David Mullins is leaving to become a partner in a new investment management firm. His departure lets President Clinton appoint another new governor to the central bank board. It's independent of government control. The Federal Reserve sets key economic policy. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow dropped 14 points to end the day at 3,964. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has chosen Ecuador's ambassador to become the UN's new Commissioner for Human Rights. It's a newly created position, although it was first proposed nearly half a century ago. Analysts say José Ayala Lasso's nomination is virtually certain to be supported by the UN General Assembly. PLO leader Yasser Arafat says he's ready to sign immediately the draft agreement reached with Israel last weekend on Palestinian self-rule. He's also warning further delay could jeopardize the peace process. But Israeli officials say there is still a long way to go. From Cairo, the BBC's Simon Ingram has more on the story.
Not for the first time, the PLO and Israel have found themselves at odds in their account of what was achieved at the last round of negotiations. No one disputes that genuine progress was made at last weekend's meeting between Mr. Arafat and the Israeli Foreign Minister, Mr. Peres, held in the Swiss ski resort of Davos. but just how much negotiating remains to be done is unclear. Mr. Arafat, speaking in Geneva, said he was ready to sign the so-called Davos Agreement immediately, warning that further delay risked undermining the entire peace process. However, he added that the Israelis had insisted on a week's delay to study the document's contents fully. Reports from Jerusalem say the Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and his military chiefs are worried about the extent of concessions made to the PLO on security questions.
Simon Ingram reporting. Burundi's ambassador to Belgium says at least 80 people have died in new ethnic violence in his country. He told Belgian radio the Tutsi-dominated army isn't stopping the violence, which has left dozens of people hurt. Diplomatic sources say most of the deaths came yesterday after youths from the minority Tutsi tribe overturned buses. The fighting stems from a crisis over the choice of a new president. The last president was killed in an attempted coup last October. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
From NBC Studios in New York, it's Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
If you ask me, the best late-night theme belongs to Conan O'Brien Show. The band is led by drummer Max Weinberg, formerly of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. The first record Weinberg made with Springsteen was Born to Run, the album which landed Springsteen on the cover of Time and Newsweek in October 1975. Weinberg stayed with Springsteen until the E Street Band broke up in 1989. Weinberg says that when he was growing up in the 50s, trying to find his own beat, he listened to every drummer he could. Now he pays tribute to his favorite rock and roll drummers of the 50s, 60s, and 70s in a new CD series that he produced called Let There Be Drums. The series shows off the work of other drummers, but on one track you can hear Weinberg playing with Springsteen. It's one of Weinberg's favorite tracks he's ever recorded. It's called Candy's Room.
Candy's Room, lyrically, is one of the romantic, most romantic songs I've ever heard. Drumistically, it was always fun to play. It's a single-stroke roll, which, not to be too technical, is just something I played on the snare drum. Mm. And it created a lot of inner tension in the music. And then in the middle of the song, the so-called middle eight, I go to another part of the drum set and it releases the tension. So I always try to play the drums as if I was the sort of landscape that the action took place on. And I think in Candy's Room, that I think I accomplished that.
Well, why don't we hear Candy's Room from your new anthology, Max Weinberg Presents Let There Be Drums.
There's a sadness hidden in that pretty face, a sadness all her own, from which no man can keep candy safe. We kissed, my heart rushes through my brain, and the blood rushes in my veins, the fire rushes through the sky. Driving deep into the night, I go driving deep into the light. Candy's eyes, she says, baby, if you wanna be wild, you gotta
walk. I want to talk with you a little bit later about your years with the Bruce Springsteen band, but I want to talk about what you're doing now. Now you're leading the band on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. How'd you get to be the drummer on Late Night?
I actually met Conan in the street shortly after he was tapped for the gig. And we were talking about music, and I was interested in pursuing something like that. And one thing led to another, and we hit the air on September 13th. And it's been a fantastic situation ever since.
So you talked him into hiring you when you met him on the street?
Well, I didn't really talk him into it. He had his own very definite ideas of what he wanted, he along with the producers of the show. And it was kind of aligned with the way I wanted to go. I wanted to become more instrumentally based. I'd certainly put my time in with, playing behind Bruce with the E Street Band. It was a glorious time playing behind one of, my generation's premier singer-songwriters. But as a drummer, I wanted to move away from that type of a situation into an area where I could play instrumental music. That fit in perfectly with what with Conan and everybody up there wanted to do. They wanted to have a band that was fun. So we're playing a sort of new version of jump blues, which was a genre popular in the late 40s and early 50s. It was the precursor to rock and roll. And we throw in a Sinatra tune every once in a while because I'm a fanatic Sinatra fan.
I want to get back to your new Rhino collection. Max Weinberg presents Let There Be Drums, a three-volume set featuring some of your favorite drumming performances. You have a recording on here featuring Bernard Purdy with Aretha Franklin doing Rock Steady. And you actually studied with Bernard Purdy, didn't you?
Well, Bernard Purdy was the great 60s soul drummer on into the 70s. And he's still playing, of course, who played with everyone from James Brown to Steely Dan to Aretha Franklin, for whom he did his best work, in my estimation. And Rock Steady was one of his standout tracks recorded in the early 70s. And he sort of defined rhythm and blues and soul drumming in the 60s. He was the premier drummer of that genre and was always one of my favorites. And I sought him out when I was 19 because I'd heard he taught in New York City, and I studied with him for about 3 years, which was more about absorbing his vibe than it was about book studies.
What was the vibe that you wanted to absorb?
I wanted to know and feel how he played so funky.
Uh-huh.
And he showed me, and it was about going to Harlem with him to go to clubs. And one time he took me to see Aretha at the Apollo. And it was as much about absorbing what he considered the things you should stay focused on as it was about, you know, reading books. It was a tremendous experience. And I would say that most beats I play in some way have a lot to do with Bernard Purdy.
Why did you choose Rock Steady for your anthology?
Well, it's just one of my favorite songs. It's also got this little four-bar drum solo in the middle that drummers, since it was recorded, have been trying to figure out how it's played. And Rocksteady, the image of Rocksteady is exactly what Bernard Purdy is. He's Rocksteady. And it's a groove. And, you know, that is all a song has to do.
Well, why don't we hear Aretha Franklin and Rocksteady with drummer Bernard Purdy. Max Weinberg is my guest, and we just heard another selection from his three-volume anthology, Let There Be Drums, featuring some of his favorite drumming performances. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Max Weinberg, let's talk a little bit about your years with Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. From what I know about you, this was your first real gig. I mean, where you had a long, a well paying is underestimating it, but you know, a real like long term job. Before that, it was real hand to mouth, wasn't it?
It was quite the opposite, actually. From an early age, I found a way to be gainfully employed as a drummer. And the way to do that was always be in service of someone else.
Uh-huh.
So I became the kind of drummer at a very early age. I started playing when I was 6. Oh, by the time I was 11, I was playing with people much older than me, working every weekend, because I knew what they wanted. They wanted a supportive drummer. They wanted someone to keep the beat.
Who's the they? What kind of gigs were these?
Oh, these were everything from, in the early days, weddings and bar mitzvahs to talent shows to when I was 14, I played in strip joints.
Really?
I had a very, very well-rounded musical education. Later on, I played cruise ships. I played every kind of job imaginable. I've played for the circus, local circuses that would come to town. I was an all-around drummer. Rock and roll was, of course, my first love. And when I met Bruce and the band in the summer of 1974, it seemed to me as if everything I'd been doing up until that point led me to that place. In 1974, I'd been playing drums already for close to 17 years.
Now, how would playing bar mitzvahs and strip joints and circuses lead you musically to Springsteen?
Well, all those early experiences came out in all the music we played, whether it was an extended jazz sort of jam like we did in Kitty's Back early on, or some of the sort of vaudevillian bits that Bruce and Clarence Clemons would pull out. All that experience created a knowledge in me of how to cut a show, which is what drummers are supposed to do. Or at least in my view, that's what they're supposed to do. Cutting a show is being able to play more than just what you want. It's being able to play what other people want. And that's why I was always able to work as a drummer.
How did you meet Springsteen and join the band?
Well, Bruce and the band put an ad in the Village Voice in 1974 looking for a drummer. Looking for a drummer and a keyboard player. And it said, wanted drummer, no junior Ginger Bakers. And Ginger Baker was the legendary drummer of Cream. And he was very flamboyant, and he did long drum solos. And I saw that, and that indicated to me that I was the guy for the job because he wanted an accompanist. That's what I sensed, and that's what I found out later. At the time, I was playing in the Broadway show Godspell, 8 performances a week. And went down, 60 drummers went down. And I pulled out the job, and it was really love at first sight. You know, it was a fit that just happened great.
You know how Springsteen on stage, well, obviously you know this, how Springsteen on stage would sometimes do this kind of male bonding thing with another one of the musicians. As the drummer, you know, you're stationary and you're in a chair. You know what I mean? You're not moving closer to Springsteen and trading licks with him visibly as well as musically. Is that the kind of thing you'd ever feel comfortable doing if you weren't a drummer? Or are you just as glad to be stationary in a chair, you know, on a stool?
No, I never really I felt any lack of communication or closeness, particularly when we played the stadiums. You know, it's interesting, when you're playing for 50, 60,000 people a night on a routine basis, you get very used to playing for that kind of crowd, and it doesn't seem that big.
Mm-hmm.
And our stage, that is the E Street Band stage, was a very intimate place, very intimate. And if you had been dropped down onto that stage, the thing you would have noticed was how relaxed it was.
Mm-hmm.
We were just doing our business, and we did that business the same wherever we played, whether it was in a rehearsal studio, we used to rehearse off Bruce's bedroom, or in Madison Square Garden, or in Giant Stadium in New Jersey. The energy from that band always remained constant.
Why did the band break up?
Well, it was just time for everyone to move in different directions.
Did you feel it was time?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we had done what we set out to do, and that was very important. We had a real goal, and we accomplished it. And we grew up together. You know, when I met Bruce, I was 23. We broke up when I was almost 39. And, you know, in the beginning, it was a gang. It was a bunch of guys on the road living in cars. And it ended up with all of us having families and new responsibilities and new perspectives. And it was a normal growth pattern. And, you know, we broke up, what, 4 years ago. And, you know, life has been one incredibly blossoming experience after another for me, you know, culminating certainly with, I left drumming for several years to develop other interests. I went to law school briefly. Went to law school briefly. I started a record label. Wanted to explore things I'd always been interested in, but never had the opportunity to do it. I was fortunate enough to play for the inauguration last year, and it was the first time in a long time that I'd played. I really enjoyed it, and I started to think, well, maybe I should get back into drumming, which I did. And it was almost like that movie Field of Dreams. I just started to play drums again and rediscover what I loved about playing the drums, which was, it's fun.
I want to ask you, I know you used to have tendonitis. Did you get rid of that? Did you have surgery or something that was able to fix it?
I did. I had a bad case of tendonitis in 7 fingers. I had 7 operations. The last one was in 1985, and it's been clear sailing ever since.
That's great.
So fortunate.
You don't have to soak your hands anymore or do anything like that?
I have to warm up. I have to recognize the fact that drumming is a very athletic endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
When I started and I was 15 and 16, I could play with total wild abandon. I'm 43 years old now. I'm going to be 43 in April. And, you know, as you get older, you feel the aches and pains a little bit more. It's like being a football player. I can kind of relate to Joe Montana.
My guest is Max Weinberg. He leads the band on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He was the longtime drummer with Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, and now he's produced a 3-CD anthology paying tribute to his favorite drummers called Let There Be Drums. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the Tonya Harding story?
Hi, Terry. We'll have the latest from Portland, Oregon. Tonya Harding's ex-husband has now named Ms. Harding as a co-conspirator in the plot to attack Nancy Kerrigan. A report on President Clinton's choice to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Deval Patrick, a Boston lawyer. This is the job for which Mr. Clinton first chose Lonnie Guinier. Also a conversation with the actor Michael Moriarty, the star of NBC's Law and Order. He's now resigned from that program in frustration with what he says is NBC's response to the issue of television violence. Moriarty warned strongly against government interference in this issue.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with drummer Max Weinberg. I want to get back to your CD, your new anthology, Let There Be Drums, featuring some of your favorite drumming performances. And I want to play something with Al Jackson on it. And we're going to hear Soul Man, which you've included on this. Tell us something about Al Jackson.
Well, Al Jackson, who was senselessly murdered in 1975, tremendous loss to the world of drumming, was the epitome of the less is more school of drumming. He played with Booker T and the MGs. He was the drummer on the great hits like Soul Man, Try a Little Tenderness, Otis Redding, Respect, all that stuff that came out of Memphis in the mid-60s. And I never met the man. I've only talked to people he knew him, and he has really grown into a legendary figure in drum circles. He had the toughest beat around. And I worked briefly in the 80s with a gentleman named Tom Dowd, who's himself a legend as a recording engineer and producer, who worked a lot with Al Jackson. And everyone thought, drummers typically think that Al Jackson's brilliance came from the way he laid back the second and fourth beat, the so-called backbeats. In other words, he played with a tremendous restraint. Tom Dowd once said to me, well, he did do that, but the real secret was that he hit that 1 and 3 on the bass drum right on the money every time. And it was a real lesson to me. Every time I listen to Al Jackson drumming, I pick up something new. He is by far the most elegant drummer, I think, in the history of rock and roll.
Although some people might listen and think, big deal, he's not doing anything fancy here.
That's true. They may think that, and they'd be wrong. Well, they'd be right in that he's not doing anything fancy, but they'd be wrong in not appreciating the tremendous subtlety with which he played. And that's a very important part of successful drumming, because you can make an awful lot of racket with a drum set. And to be able to play sweetly and with the kind of brilliance that he exhibited is no mean feat.
Didn't Al Jackson play with Al Green, too?
He did. He played on a lot of the early hits. Yeah, he did. So, Let's Stay Together, I think, is him.
Well, this is Al Jackson on drums. Soul Man. Listening to music from Max Weinberg's 3-volume CD, Let There Be Drums, featuring some of his favorite drumming performances. Max Weinberg, something I have to ask you. Your parents owned a summer camp in the Poconos when you were young?
Correct.
What was the camp?
Well, the camp was operated until 1966, and it was called Laurel Lake Camps.
So did you play in a band at summer camp?
Well, I had my band up there, sure, and we played every Thursday and Saturday night for dances.
So you were like the house band of your parents' summer camp.
I was.
God, that's really great. Since you played for so many bar mitzvahs and weddings, who'd you get to play for your bar mitzvah and your wedding?
Well, actually, our group played for my wedding. I got married in 1981, and Bruce was kind enough to, you know, ask everybody in the band if you know, to provide the music at my wedding. So we did about a 2 hour set.
And you had to play?
Yeah, and I played at my own wedding. It was great because we had about 350 people there, and it was just a wild party. It was great.
One of the records on your anthology is Wipeout. Even I practiced the Wipeout solo on restaurant tables. Everybody would. Did you do that? Or you probably had drums to do that on, right? You got
Wipeout was a staple. If you didn't know how to play Wipeout at a high school dance in 1966, you were wiped out, really.
Yeah.
You had to do that. And, you know, it was one of those dumb songs that's just fun to play. You know, we do a warm-up at Conan's show, and somebody called out from the audience a couple of weeks ago, hey, can you guys play Wipeout? We went right into it, and it sounded great.
Well, it's really been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. It's good to talk to you.
Max Weinberg leads the band on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He was the longtime drummer with Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, and now he's produced a 3-CD anthology paying tribute to his favorite drummers called Let There Be Drums. It's on Rhino Records.
Wipeout!
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistants from Louisa Shafia, Devin Reif, and Anne Neville are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins is considered by some critics the greatest living jazz improviser. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rollins about his music and his life. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.